Okay, thank you for the invitation to speak about my research in neighborhood context and how nursing research can be used to improve the health of communities. I'm particularly delighted to be here with so many public health nurses and practitioners who actually make a difference in individuals and communities every day. I have no disclosures. First, let me set the stage for what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to focus on four areas: background for context, the reasons that context and macro level determinants are so important, how I got interested in it, and some specific examples from my own research in this area, and then finally, recommendations for the future. It seems really appropriate that this year's theme is healthography because it recognizes the influence of geography on health. When we begin to broaden our concept of geography and include context and the environment, we understand that individuals, families, and communities' lives and where they live and work really makes a difference in some health outcomes. In nursing, of course, this is not a new idea. Starting with Florence Nightingale, Lillian Wald, and others, nurses have long recognized the need to improve the environment or the context. In the past 40 years, of course, this has been a field that has been rapidly growing, and so the importance of context using this macro level approach has gained even more significance. Now, when I do presentations about my research, sometimes people ask me, is geography a nursing research topic? Because, and I'm probably speaking to, you know, the choir right now, but I do get that a lot. Well, increasingly, we know that we're finding evidence to support what we have hypothesized all along, and that's really part of what we do with nursing research, is we may have this hypothesis, and we know this in our gut, but we really need to do the research to be able to show that what we're interested in makes a difference to policymakers, to other researchers. And so we're in the phase where we're looking at gathering evidence that supports that space and place affect health. And so using tools such as geographic information systems or GIS, multi-level linear modeling, and ecological theoretical models involving that macro-level perspective, we're able to better understand how context influences health. So let's just start off looking at, I'm not going to give you a lot of examples of health indicators because there are a lot of health indicators, but let's look at a few of them. When we look at the now familiar maps of the distribution of certain health indicators in the United States, it becomes evident that the health problems are very complex. Anybody who's been working in this field knows that it is very complex, and that many of these health indicators are influenced in part by geography and context. For example, the South looks much different than the West. Although the country is all catching up, I mean, the South still looks a little bit worse. Approximately 25% of Americans report inadequate leisure time activity, and less than 21% of adults meet the federal physical activity guidelines for aerobic and muscle strengthening activities in leisure time. It's also clear that to improve the health of populations, we must employ new approaches in order to understand and intervene at multiple levels. For a long time, we focused on just the individual level, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. One organizing framework is a socio-ecological approach, and one of the very familiar ones is the Institute of Medicine socio-ecological model. Although you know, if you've been working in this field, that there are many. The socio-ecological approach acknowledges that it's a combination of not only individual, but also of the environmental, the contextual, and policy initiatives that influence health. And so now I'm going to transition and tell you a little bit about some of my research in this area. My research began with an interest in health and health behavior, specifically physical activity. I questioned, and probably many of you all have had this same question, if physical activity is so important to health, then why is it so hard to get people to do? And I think I'm probably a great researcher for physical activity research because it's hard for me to do as well. So was it something broader? Was it something in the social environment? Was it the built environment? Was it some of the social determinants that kept it from making long-term substantial changes? And when I looked at the physical activity research, and I began this with my doctoral program, there are a lot of physical activity interventions that have been very successful, but it's been harder to maintain those changes in behavior over the long term. And so that's how I got interested in looking at the social determinants and the neighborhood contextual variables. So we know that low levels of physical activity are a very important independent risk factor for cardiovascular disease, cancer, and many other chronic illnesses. And oh, by the way, I wore red today just to kind of highlight and remind us all that heart disease is the number one killer of men and women, and that one in four women die from heart disease. So, and we also know that in certain groups, we know this from previous research, in certain groups, physical activity is lower. And so in minority populations, in people with lower socioeconomic status, and there were regional differences, the South is different, and I showed you that slide a few minutes ago, and then in older adults. So the first two studies that I'm going to tell you about are using data from the Jackson Heart Study, which is the largest all-African-American cohort study ever conducted in the United States. The first study was my dissertation, and it was using partial data, first 2 years of four-year enrollment. So I'm really going to focus more on the replication and expansion, the second study. But both of these studies looked at the influence of neighborhood context on two types of physical activity. There were four types that were measured in the Jackson Heart Study. The first type that we looked at was active living, and the second one was sports and exercise. Studies focusing on different types of physical activity in an all-African-American cohort are extremely rare. And those studies that do exist usually will focus on either walking behavior or sports and exercise only. So in the Jackson Heart Study, 5302 African Americans were enrolled, there were 21 to 95 at baseline. I used a geographic information system to locate participants resident and link that to the neighborhood where they lived. And that technique is called geocoding, and I think probably a lot of you all are aware of that. And then I used multi-level linear models to begin to tease apart the influence of neighborhood from that of individual. And I don't know if anybody uses a GIS, but you get really cool maps. But not only do you get cool, pretty maps, but they actually are very descriptive. I mean, they can tell a really great story in a short amount of time. And this is just a sample of one of the maps we ran that shows the number of participants that were enrolled per neighborhood. And in this case, it was census tracts. What we found was an independent effect of neighborhood on both active living and sports and exercise, and that confirmed that of other studies which have shown a neighborhood effect on multiple outcomes. For active living, about 3% of the variance in physical activity scores was accounted for. And while that may seem small, it could have huge public health and population health implications. And then the data for the sports and exercise were analyzed using multi-level logistic regression. And again, we found that neighborhood was a varied significantly among the different neighborhoods. Neighborhood education and urban-type neighborhoods were the only neighborhood-level variables with an effect on physical activity in both of these studies. We also looked at percent of African Americans per neighborhood as a proxy for segregation, looked at median neighborhood income and neighborhood stress, and none of those were significant predictors. For active living, there was a significant cross-level effect for the interaction between individual and neighborhood education, which supports the hypothesis that neighborhood and individual factors act together to really kind of potentiate each other. We also found that living in an urban-type neighborhood had an inverse relationship on active living, so that the mean scores for active living were lower in urban neighborhoods. The next study was a study that I did during my postdoc in Detroit, Michigan. It looked at determinants for walking in older African Americans living in an urban setting. Little is known about how the neighborhood context affects walking in older adults. So we used a mixed method design. We recruited African American 60 years old and older through a convenient sample. And the study had two phases. The first phase was the qualitative phase, and the second phase included quantitative. In preparation for, we had focus groups. We held four focus groups. We had 21 participants who participated in the four focus groups. And in preparation for those, participants had the option of participating in photo voice, which is a technique. I think probably everybody knows about photo voice, but it's a technique where what we did was we asked participants to take pictures in their neighborhood of things that encouraged or discouraged their walking. And we used those photographs to really kind of facilitate the discussion during the focus groups. And then for phase two, we recruited 36 participants, but I'm really going to focus on the findings from phase one. The predominant themes that emerged for neighborhood walking were the presence of people, neighborhood surroundings, safety from crime, sidewalks and traffic, animals, and public tracks and trails. Factors within these themes both encouraged and discouraged, so it really kind of depended. Safety from crime was reported as a predominant theme, but it did not serve as a absolute deterrent to walking. So one of the serendipitous findings that I was most excited about was that participants found ways to continue to walk in their neighborhood, even though they lived in a neighborhood that they perceived as being very unsafe. And that wouldn't have come out if we had done just a survey or questionnaire. It would have only come out through the interviews. So they developed strategies to walk safely in their neighborhood, such as walking during the daytime, which that makes sense. Or the thing that I found interesting was they would, several of them would walk in the early morning because there might be drug dealers on the block, but they'd be up late, and so they'd sleep late. And so the participants would go out early in the morning when their neighbors were still asleep. Interpretation of the photographs was provided by the participants to focus on what their perception of their neighborhood environment was rather than on what we thought as the researchers. For example, one participant who walked regularly in her neighborhood took photographs of her usual route, and it included a vacant lot. And that was a characteristic that had come out in several of the focus groups as being something that discouraged walking. So we asked her about that, and she explained that that on that lot used to be two vacant houses and that there was a lot of overgrowth in the yard and spilling over into the sidewalk. And so she never really felt safe because she didn't know if somebody was in the house or not, and she didn't know if somebody was hiding in the bushes. Once they tore down the houses and they mowed the lots, she felt safe again, and so she could walk in the neighborhood. Because we left that analysis of the photographic data to the participants to describe what characteristics encouraged or discouraged their walking, a framework was for organizing the material grew out of the experiences of the participants rather than what we as researchers had our preconceived notions about what was going on. The next study is one that many of you might be aware of. The University of Mississippi Medical Center had one of the Vanguard sites that opened before the full study was to be conducted. The full study now, I think, is slated to open about 2015. The National Children's Study grew out of the conclusions from the President's Task Force on Environmental Health and safety risks to children, and that was held in 2000. And their conclusions were that compared to adults, children are especially vulnerable to environmental exposures. Exposures such as to some agents can have serious developmental effects, such as lead or prenatal alcohol. And in addition, many children are currently exposed at high frequency to many exposures, such as violence, pesticides, and the media. The task force noted that numerous high-burden conditions have a suspected environmental influence, such as autism, learning disabilities, diabetes, asthma, birth defects, and premature birth. So their conclusion was that existing research really was insufficient to be able to answer some of the research questions. In fact, they will enroll 100,000 children and follow them from birth or pre-birth, because some people will be recruited when they're still pregnant to 21 years of age. So as part of the National Children's Study, at our site, we developed a neighborhood assessment audit tool called the CHARM. The CHARM's based on the Neighborhood Inventory for Environmental Topography, which is also called the NIFTY tool, and it includes additional items from numerous other inventories. The National Children's Study has been undergoing reorganization, and so the University of Mississippi Medical Center is no longer, there's still a site there, but we're no longer managing the National Children's Study, Hinds County, Mississippi site. So after the reorganization, we continued our work with the CHARM because we had put a lot of work into it and we think it's really kind of nice, although it's a little bit long, I'll have to tell you. And we are, what we're doing is we're conducting neighborhood level assessments that include the built environment and the social environment, the economic. So it really is very comprehensive. And we've had students involved, and the students have been undergraduates. They've been some students who were working on their master's in social work. We've had PhD students, and that's been really pretty exciting. The we had previously identified some issues with, because the CHARM is pretty lengthy. It's 180 items. And so we were doing it with paper and pencil data collection. Students would go two in a car, always go two, and they would always drive the neighborhoods because one would drive and the other one would be completing the assessment. So, but what we noticed was that it was taking a lot of time to complete this instrument, and that then you had to come back and you had to enter the data into SPSS for data analysis, and so then there were data entry issues as well. So the time involved was really pretty long. So what we decided was that we needed to look at, in the field, direct data entry using tablet PCs. So we gained some funding to buy the needed software to do that and to evaluate the efficacy and efficiency of doing it, the direct data entry into the tablet PCs versus the paper and pencil. And so really, all we've done so far, and this is a picture of the tablet PC that we have used, what we've done is a very small pilot. And so there are still some issues with the way the paper and pencil and the tablet PC, actually the questions are not, you've got to have somebody program it correctly. So some of that, we've identified some issues that need to be cleaned up with that. But the thing that I thought was really pretty interesting is that students who were involved really got very excited about public health, about neighborhood context, and they actually were They gained a whole new insight into what neighborhoods looked like. They tended to think that all neighborhoods looked like their neighborhood, and that if it didn't look like their neighborhood, it was a bad neighborhood. And so there was a lot of, I would go out with them, and I would say, that's not actually, just because the house is small, and the yard is maybe small and it doesn't look like your new brick home, that doesn't mean it's a bad neighborhood. The houses, if you look more closely, the houses are well kept, they're painted, people have flowers in their yard. This is a neighborhood that really is a very healthy neighborhood. The other thing was, it was really kind of interesting to see them mentor each other, because some of the students had done some of the paper and pencil data collection, and so they were kind of experts. And so when other students would ride with them, they were able to kind of mentor the students, which was really kind of exciting. And of course, there were some advantages to the faculty researchers. They paid really close attention. They wanted to do such a good job. They paid close attention to detail. And some of the students, particularly the PhD students, were able to see the bigger picture, and they were able to make some suggestions on how the instrument could work better, because they were actually the ones who were using it. So they really became a vital part of the team, and they really had ownership. The next study is the Deep South Network for Cancer Control, and that is a collaboration between the University of Mississippi, University of Alabama at Birmingham, the University of Mississippi Medical Center, and community partners in 20 communities across Mississippi and Alabama. As part of the Deep South Network's research core, we sought to describe the built environment, the policies, and the availability of facilities for physical activity in 8 rural communities to inform a diet and physical activity intervention as part of this ongoing academic community partnership that aims to eliminate cancer disparities in the Deep South. So we used the Rural Active Living Assessment, also called the RALA, and I'm not sure if anybody's very familiar with it. It's fairly new. I think it was the publication that talks about it was 2010, and I can give you those references if you would like. But what we did was we used the RALA to assess the neighborhood characteristics, the townwide facilities, and the town programs and policies for physical activity in those 8 counties within the Alabama Black Belt and the Mississippi Delta. The RALA has 3 separate instruments. The first is a street segment assessment, which assesses the built environment. So that's like a lot of the different audit tools that you've probably used before. The townwide assessment assesses the characteristics of the community as a whole, including the population, the total area, and the presence of recreational amenities. So it gives you a better idea of the context of people's lives. And then the town program and policy assessment captures information on community programs and policies that support physical activity, like policies about bike lanes, requiring sidewalks in new residential areas, and also programs that are offered by the Public Recreation Department. Several advantages of the Rural Active Living Assessment are that it's designed specifically for use in rural communities, and that 2 of the tools, the townwide assessment and the town program and policy assessment, can be scored so that you can have a baseline, you can then do an intervention in the community, and then you can measure whether or not your intervention made a difference. And it also can be used to compare different communities. And that's really kind of what we did, was we compared the communities in Alabama and Mississippi. And what we found was that the street segment assessment showed that there were built environmental barriers to physical activity in all of the communities. Alabama communities had more sidewalks and better connectivity to places that people could walk to, but those features were only present in about half of those Alabama communities. But of the segments that were assessed in both Alabama and Mississippi, the majority were rated as walkable and aesthetically pleasing. Based on our findings, the communities evaluated in this study lacked a strong base for policies and programs that supported physical activity, particularly outside those policies that related to local schools. The townwide assessment identified parks and playgrounds as the most consistently available community feature, and built environmental features such as sidewalks or walkable shoulders, town programs and policy initiatives such as requiring walking paths in new residential areas, or policies that would open up school tracks for after-hour community use, and townwide amenities such as parks can help to provide additional opportunities for members of rural communities to be more physically active. And the last study I'm going to talk about has not actually yet begun, but has important implications for understanding context and physical activity. Mississippi had the highest rate of obesity from 2005 to 2008, and then last year's statistics, it's tied for number one again. The trend, of course, continues, and Mississippi also ranks first in hypertension, diabetes, and inactivity. According to the Mississippi State Department of Health, obesity is one of the state's most pressing health issues. Racial disparities in childhood overweight and obesity in the Mississippi Delta far exceed that of the rest of the state or of the nation. So the environment in which rural kids live is a complex web of many factors, individual, contextual, policy, and social factors that might put them at risk for overweight and obesity. In two of the counties, Issaquena and Sharkey County in the Mississippi Delta, the rates of poverty are particularly high. And we know that overweight children in rural areas are more likely than urban children to live in households that are below 200% of the federal poverty level, to have more medical comorbidities, to participate in more sedentary activities, to have not received preventative health care in the last year, and have limited access to retail food outlets. Thus, there's evidence that the rural settings, poverty, and the built-in social environments are important. Looking at national trends since about 2000, the disparities between white and black children and adolescents has been stable, with minority children having approximately 10 to 20% higher obesity rates, indicating little progress in reducing those weight disparities. So, how did we get to the Mississippi Delta? Anybody who's done any kind of research in the community knows that you have to build trust first. And the School of Nursing has a program called the Mississippi Delta Express Project, which began in the year 2000. It was a partnership between the University of Mississippi Medical Center School of Nursing and the Sisters of Mercy at Vicksburg, with representation from key stakeholders from the Mississippi Department of Health, private health care providers, residents of Issaquena County, community leaders, policy experts, and others. And then in 2003, the Sisters of Mercy donated a mobile van to the School of Nursing, to the Mississippi Delta Express Project, to deliver health care in the Mississippi Delta. So the Mississippi Delta Express Project provides school-based health care to children in the South Delta School District, which serves 1,100 students in both Sharkey and Issaquena counties. There are no pediatricians in either one of these counties. Thus, it serves an important need and fills a gap in care through the provision of medical, dental, and health education services. And in addition, it serves as a clinical learning experience for the nursing students and dental students as well. In 2011, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation awarded the School of Nursing a grant to expand the Mercy Delta Express project and establish permanent in-house school-based nursing clinics at the South Delta Middle School in Anguilla, the South Delta Elementary School in Rolling Fork, and the Ripley-Blackwell Head Start in Myersville. Through the Mercy Delta Express project, we have that long-standing clinical relationship with the people in those two counties that we will build on to develop now research collaboration with the community. And we will be able to learn from the community while providing those much-needed services. So the two Mississippi Delta counties where we've been involved since 2000 are particularly disparate. The nurse practitioners working in the mobile and school-based clinics express their discouragement at the high rates of obesity in overweight children and obesity-related comorbidities. So from those discussions, we designed a research study to address the problem, and that grant is currently under review. The unique dynamics of Mississippi and the Delta region warrant that socio-ecological approach. What we plan to do is listen to the community using photo voice, focus groups, individual interviews, and the RALA assessments. Because we felt like a lot of money has been poured into interventions to improve health in the Mississippi Delta, and we've not seen real substantial change. And so we're taking a step back, and maybe it's because most of those interventions have been researcher-led. We haven't really listened to what the community might want, and we've not listened to them when they kind of prioritized what it was that they needed for their own community. So, kind of in conclusion, most of the U.S. and Mississippi health problems are caused by behaviors and environmental factors rather than by infectious disease. 7 of the 10 leading causes of U.S. deaths are from chronic diseases. The leading causes of premature death, injury, and disability are related to 6 risk factors. That of tobacco use, poor diet, sedentary lifestyle, intentional and unintentional injury, drug and alcohol abuse, and sexual activity. And many of these risk factors have an environmental component. For example, one of the latest reports from the CDC noted that the highest number of potentially preventable premature deaths from the top 5 causes of death was in the Southeast U.S., a geographic region that has a huge health burden. And it also kind of highlights that geography plays an important part. We've made notable progress at improving the health of the U.S. population, but there is so much more left to do. So because of the foundations, the focus, the holistic understanding of the broader context of people's lives, and the ability to work in collaboration with other disciplines and with communities, nurses and nursing research are needed to improve the population health. Important work has been done in setting a public health nursing research agenda for the future, with one of the key priorities to develop and test population-focused interventions. Further, I would recommend collaborating with colleagues to develop larger multi-site studies to utilize many of the tools such as geographic information system and advanced statistics that can begin to tease apart the influence of neighborhood or context from that of the individual and using large data sets that are readily available. Thank you. And my contact information is